Welcome to the Workflow Show, episode 109, the year 2525.
In the year 2525.
Yes, I'm Merrill Davis, along with my cohort, Mr. Nick Gold, and today, we're going to talk a little bit about
the future.
That was good, man.
We didn't even plan to do
no,
that.
No, but, we totally locked eyes, though. It was kind of awkward. I guess the genesis of this podcast episode came from Nick and I discussing about a PlayStation 9 commercial.
It sure did. You guys
remember that?
You guys may remember this. It was one of my favorite television commercials ever.
Back when the PlayStation 2 came out.
It was one of their launch ads from before the 2 came out. And they had this ad, and I was telling Meryl, I thought this was brilliant advertising because it's this ad for like the PlayStation 9 100 years out from now where you're literally inhaling through your nose in a very kind of drug-like fashion these nanomolecules that literally change your sensory perception and put you in this virtual internet reality. And they're advertising this crazy video game system from the future, and then they're like, PlayStation 9, download it today or something. And then...
then it was PlayStation 2.
Yeah, they just show this cool little, like, it almost looks like the obelisk or whatever, the monolith in 2001. The black side turns and it goes PlayStation 2.
Yeah,
the beginning.
And it was really clever advertising for the time.
Because it's tying, you're like, oh my God, I can make this future happen if I buy this thing now. And it's connecting me with this cool set of technologies that maybe someday I'll get to live through. So anyway, we were watching this cool ad on YouTube. You can just look YouTube, you know, PlayStation 9 ad, and you'll be able to see it. It's awesome. So we started talking about, well, what's coming down the pike for what we deal with.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we can conjecture about next year, the year after, whether or not there's going to be Mac Pro, what version of the iPhone,
and we do that from time to time,
and all that, you know, wonderful stuff. But let's look like far reaching. When you put it into perspective, the technology that we have today is something that was science fiction 35 years ago.
I mean, 10 or 15.
And, you know, just the other day, I was playing my Pandora station, and Nick says, this is a great station. I said, you know, I've been training it for about 4.5 years. And he commented, what did you say?
I was like, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, if you were in like, yeah, I've been training my artificially intelligent internet-based radio station software to really know exactly the type of specific easy listening 80s tunes I'm into. It would have been like, dude, what are you on?
Yeah. But
that's some sci-fi BS.
But here it is on my iPhone
and it's
my Blu-ray player.
I think it's probably one of the best easy listening 80s artificial intelligence radio DJs in existence.
It is. And the name of the station is Betty Davis Eyes.
You know, it should be Betty Davis AIs. Okay. So,
all right.
So how many years out are we projecting here?
So let's you know, even though we're calling this the year 2525, let's project
end of the
it
decade.
Out. End of the decade.
End of the decade. 20 okay. The year 2020.
What's going to be going on in the world of production?
Yeah. We're going to talk about three areas. Production, we'll hit up some post
production,
delivery and consumption,
workflow,
and beyond.
And beyond. Which is, you know, falls in the PlayStation 9 category. I insisted upon it. Nick was like, what's beyond? I'm like, you know, we'll get there.
Stay tuned.
So, yes.
Listen to the end of the episode because it's going to get wacky.
How do we do things? Well, first, we would cover the changes that have happened up to now.
So,
we obviously went to a tapeless workflow in the most recent years.
Obviously. So there's videotape. Dare I even say data tape? Well, no. I think there'll still be data tape. But as far as production side, like shooting a commercial, shooting a movie, I mean, what's changed over the last few years? Let's project that forward. My iPhone has a 1080p camera built in it now. Pretty decent quality. The sensor's decent. The glass is actually relatively decent. I mean, it's obviously not a Panavision setup. But
not yet.
It's serviceable. What I think we could say is that by the end of the decade, my guess would be, you tell me if you think this sounds hokey
or
not.
Sure, no.
But that the cost of the IT aspects of the technology will have essentially reached the consumer realm. And the thing that'll make your actual production setup expensive is the costs associated with like polishing really good lenses to professional caliber, or the physical manufacturing of a rugged enough case that, sure, you know, you can have it in, you know, a shoot under warm conditions or cold conditions. But it's not going to be the IT stuff that represents the bulk of the cost anymore. It's going to be like the limits of physics themselves and the ergonomics and the engineering of the overall package.
Sure, and maybe the overhead in data. You know, we are seeing 2K to 4K, you know, 10K. Where will we be in 2020?
And let's say by 2020, I think the ability, whether or not it's been widely embraced throughout the production, post-production, and distribution pipeline, I think it's very easy to say anything will be able to do 4K. Data storage won't be an issue. The processing limits of the device won't be
I think
limit.
That's a fair evaluation. To say in the next 8 years, right, that an iPhone-like device can do
4K.
4K?
Easy.
I think that
that's a safe bet.
That's a very safe bet.
I'd put money on that bet.
You know, I agree. I mean, and you think about the last 10 years. I mean, when I bought, which was an excellent sort of entry-level 3CCD camera, the Sony PD-170, it was one of the last DV cam cameras that really sort of I fancied before we went totally tapeless. I look at an investment like that, and even though I spent $5,000 plus on all this gear, I look at it in its case and I say, well, I'm glad at least it paid for itself, because I couldn't possibly go on a gig now and reasonably tell somebody I'm shooting on DV cam and then expense them for the tapes that I'd have to go find somewhere in a warehouse in New Jersey, perhaps.
So let me, an interesting idea just popped into my head. What do you think about this? So
Okay. We've
obviously seen a little, I'd call it a little bit of hype about stereoscopic production.
Mm-hmm.
But let's look at it from the perspective I was just talking about, where like the cost of actually building it into your equipment has probably quickly accelerated towards inconsequential. What if shooting with cameras that have many different lenses of different focal lengths that are focusing on different points of the picture simultaneously, you're like shooting this multi-lens, multi-focused rig all the time, even if you just want to create 2D video, because then in post you'll be able to have so much creative control. It's kind of like when we switch to shooting RAW or these RAW-like workflows, they give you a lot more control over the color and the color grading and color correction. What if actual like your focal length of a shot or where you're focused on actually is stuff that you
can
tweak and post?
I don't envision that as stereoscopic necessarily.
It could even be like 10 lenses.
Yeah. Well, I like the idea of having multiple lenses on the same sort of apparatus to perhaps, you know, get your wide shot and get your tight at the same time. That's interesting to me. But I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second. I'm going to say that I don't believe that 3D in its current form is really going to sustain and last. I mean, we saw it go away in the 80s. We saw the first go around of 3D, and that was kind of hokey. And even though there are some really cool things that you can do in 3D and in stereoscopic, I feel like if I were a betting man, in 8 years, it's not fully adopted and it's moving on.
My guess is that 3D in video games will grow, because it makes a lot of sense when you're running around in a three-dimensional environment for it to be three-dimensional and not just mimicked 3D. I think in cinema, when the screen is really large, there will be, like today, I mean, I think there's less stereo.
I'm not
going
to see that high level of home adoption, though. I mean, for the PS3.
Home adoption, you just hit it. When you're looking at even if it's a 50 or a 70-inch screen on the other side of the room, I just don't think it really has the same impact.
Plus, it really, you know, I saw Prometheus in 3D. It hurt my head.
A lot of people they struggle with it, you know, biologically, neurologically, however you want to describe it. It's nausea-inducing. It makes you dizzy. I mean, that's actually more of my experience of stereo when it's using like a home stereo setup, using the active shutter specs that are kind of flashing on and off, left, right eye, you know.
It is interesting what they're doing, though, on the PlayStation 3. You know, typically when you're playing a co-op game with another person and you're sharing one screen, you can see your other player.
Yeah.
But they have this really cool setup here where if you put on glasses, you can see your screen and they can see theirs.
Wait, so it uses, like, let me guess, it's using like the 120 hertz, so like half of the frames
so you're only seeing
and... Yeah. No way. They have that now?
Yeah. We'll put a link in the show notes.
So you're both
reading about
looking
it.
At the same actual television screen through your LCD shutter specs that are literally synchronized one frequency cycle off of one another. So you're only getting half the frames. They're getting half the frames. It's the other half of the frames that you're seeing through there. So you're looking at the same screen.
I really wish I had that when I was playing GoldenEye.
That's crazy, man. Because GoldenEye, which we were all raised on, the best first-person shooter ever, even to this day. Nintendo
64. Did you know
64.
That game was designed by a bunch of guys who never made an FPS ever in their entire life?
You know, that just speaks volumes about how people coming into something with a fresh set of eyes just basically create the best thing ever.
That's right.
That's fantastic. But anyway, that's just mind-blowing to me. So you don't actually have to have little quadrants on the screen where you just look a little to the left and you're seeing exactly what your opponent's doing.
I literally
can't see the. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. We'll find some. Notes
so there's
about
interesting
that.
Tricks that come of like the fundamental.
But it's
technology.
Still a novelty. It's still a novelty. And my prediction is in the year 2020, this is still going to be relegated to a novelty to IMAX movies that are nature oriented and really really large big budget action.
But again,
films.
But the idea of having multiple lenses, different focal lengths, basically different shots that just gives you a lot more flexibility in post to say, you know what, and it's the reason why people shoot large frame sizes now, even if they know they're delivering high def. It gives you a lot of room in that frame to move around your shot or to zoom in and tighten it up without losing a lot of apparent quality. I mean, imagine if you had like, well, I want to take this one shot, but I want to see how it is with that as my focal plane and that as my focal plane and do it all. Because have you heard about this new camera? I forget what it's called, but it looks like a stick of butter. And it basically...
No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I forget what it's called, but it literally looks like a stick of butter. And it's based on this technology that when it captures the data, it doesn't have a single focal plane. You actually can choose what to focus on in post through the analytics software that takes the raw data. And you can say, well, I want that thing in the foreground to be in focus, and then turn that into your single shot. Because, oh, it's called a light field camera. Because, again, it's kind of treating light as a field of data points, I guess, versus individual photons that hit a sensor from a particular focal plane. So again, it's this ability to change many aspects of what the image looks like in post because you've captured much more data. I think, in fact, those light field cameras, the same fundamental technology is eventually going to allow you to look around corners with a camera because it's able to figure out which photons it's receiving in the sensor were actually bouncing from like around a corner. And it knows how to figure out which photons that are hitting the sensor were from over there, even if over there was around a corner, because those photons have really ricocheted around and are still hitting your lens.
So that's kind of like predictive images.
Well, it's like images of the ability to see things that physics allows to be received and you know, treated like data. That is beyond what the human eye and the human sensory system is able to perceive.
So basically what we're saying is cameras, they're going to get a hell of a lot better.
And cooler and stuff that's like counterintuitive, like being able to actually construct a visual image of things that you can't see.
I mean, look at today. I mean, like you talk about something as in the past, very time intensive, stitching together a panoramic image.
Mm-hmm.
Now, default feature on an iPhone, baby.
So you know what? Another interesting trend, and you really turned me onto this one with your GoPro, and mm-hmm. you look at the GoPro thing. High-quality cameras are getting much smaller, much more rugged, and cheap as sin. So you look at the GoPro, and these people will like have these nice little rigs for like half a dozen GoPros that they attach to a top of a race car, and they don't care if they all get destroyed in the production process. And there was that Navy SEALs movie mm-hmm. where they were using DSLRs. Mm-hmm. where half the cameras got destroyed in production because they wanted to capture like machine gun bullets being shot right at it. And oops, we hit the camera. No big deal. It's a few grand, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think another trend of production is going to be that the quality of cameras and their size and their ruggedness is going to continue to get so much better.
I feel like they're going to get some parity here because...
Well, you might have dozens of cameras that you deploy from every possible angle. It'll no longer be a two-camera shoot or a three-camera shoot. There won't be any reason for it to not be like a 20-camera
shoot. And I think we're seeing that now, too. I mean, if you watch anything like... I'll give you an example. We were watching Kitchen Nightmares the other night.
I don't watch that show.
Well, you know, it's great.
Because I live it.
Because we work at a restaurant. Didn't you guys know?
I'm thinking of my kitchen at home, which...
Oh, yeah. Just imagine if Gordo came to your kitchen at home.
Holy hell.
Yeah, yeah. He'd set you straight. Though I've never seen your kitchen. I've only heard stories. But
I think I'm more apt for an episode of Hoarders or something.
Hoarders? Yeah, no, or like Celebrity Rehab. But first thing you got to do is get really famous and then like bottom out. And then I'm looking forward to seeing
you. I'm getting famous right now, man.
There you go.
That's the workflow show.
That's right. You know what? Dr. Drew, he's a great guy, I'm told. you know, on a show like...
Kitchen Nightmares.
Kitchen Nightmares. They have so many cameras. They come into the room and they mount one right by the register. They mount another one on the other side. They put one in the freezer. They put one in everywhere that you can think to put one in the alleyway in the back. They mount them. They suction cup them. And a lot of times you actually see them in the shots too. But even now you're seeing this high level of just run them. Let them go. And, you know, we'll sort it out.
But these days, a lot of them have time code problems. We talk to our clients all the time who are using these types of rigs for reality production.
So perhaps we're going
to
see...
So they'll just be more pro-grade. They'll talk to each other wirelessly. They'll do wireless time code synchronization. Maybe they'll do live streaming so you can be ingesting them into your digital recording system while they're shooting versus even having to plug them into anything.
Absolutely.
They'll self-synchronize over Bluetooth 6.0 or whatever, or Wi-Fi, the next generation...
You'll probably even have like a pan tilt zoom functionality. You can have this like in a control room, so you're streaming this all wireless from whatever GoPro or GoPro like.
And I bet you your camera operator will be wearing a little pair of glasses with a heads up display, and have their in their iPhone or something a little control application for the pan tilt zoom and da 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 da. But again, you don't even have to make directorial decisions about which camera to take while it's going, because you're going to have all of this footage, and data storage is going to be so cheap by the end of the decade. I mean, it already practically is. There's no reason not to have the 2025 ISOs and then make some decisions in post about which shots to take.
Sure.
So I think another thing that you see when you go to NAB now, and you see it at Brookstone, if you've been to Brookstone recently.
A massage chair?
No. Drones.
This is true.
You look at the AR drone. It's something like $200 or $300. It's this little quadcopter. You have software that you can control it from iPhone.
You can put a GoPro on something like that,
man. High-def cameras built into it already. You can get really high-end production caliber ones for like $10 or $20,000.
You know, that's very interesting you mentioned that. Earlier this year, I heard a very interesting NPR report about these products. And there's some airspace restriction scenarios, certainly.
But that's changing
in the United
with
States.
New legislation that Obama signed. So by 2014-ish, there will have to be a regulation system in place. This is
just think about that for a second, right?
I tell people this all the time. I'm
these
like, dude, you know, in another 5 years,
high-level, wide-angle shots of like the California coast that cost millions of dollars to helicopter shots. Right?
Little Timmy will be able to do with his toy that he got at Brookstone,
you know, or a drone or something that catches a little bit of air, and you've got some gorgeous, like, studio quality.
Oh, absolutely.
B-roll.
Like that last scene in one of the versions of Blade Runner that they actually got the footage from The Shining, where it's like going over the highway, and you're like, how does this even relate to the end of Blade Runner?
It was actually from Blade Runner originally.
No, the footage was from The Shining. And
the opening shot in The Shining where they follow the truck right over the...
So they used extra footage from it at the end of Blade Runner, and I don't know why. Blade Runner's my favorite movie. I just got the 1080p version on iTunes last night. I'm pretty much always thinking about
Little known fact, Nick has 14 versions of Blade Runner. I actually do. That's more versions than actually have been created. Somehow he's managed
to get... I've probably remixed a few of my own, you know, here and there. But as I was saying, the drone technology is not only going to get cheaper, better, more ubiquitous, there will be a legislation system in place in the next few years that make it much easier for people to have these things flying around. But here's what I think is going to be really big about them. Instead of having to manually control all of them with a joystick remote or even an iPhone app, you'll easily be able to program certain level of intelligent gathering capability into the drone platform. So you can say, oh, here's a person, here's what they look like, follow them and their face from this perspective with your camera. Or they wear a little invisible badge on their shirt and it knows how to follow them because it has a sensor that's tapping into that. I know a guy who's actually literally developing that intellectual property right now. His envisioning is for like extreme sports photography. So you can have the drone basically stay with someone as they're doing crazy skateboard tricks all throughout. And the drone knows to follow them and keep its cameras oriented around the perspective that you've told them to stay. So by the end of the decade, this will be constant.
It's basically like, well, what you've described actually is just a really like super cool version of mounting a camera on the side of a car during a chase scene.
Yeah, except now you'll be able to mount the camera hovering in the air following the car. Think about the types of really cool crap that this is going to allow people with significantly smaller budgets to do.
Sure. And you know, the way I would akin it to, if you've played the most recent Grand Theft Auto game, you have the ability to control the camera in many ways that you can't. It's one of the great things about like machinima and like all the video game based
modeling engines.
Yeah, that other stuff. You have full freedom to basically move the camera however you want, up and down, through, in places that they simply could not go in the real world.
Think about this. I wouldn't want to be a jib operator or a jib manufacturer right now. Isn't that what they call those things? Jibs,
yeah,
the
yeah.
cranes that,
yeah.
you know, because it's like you'll be able to do that with something that's just hovering there.
Well, you know, the same thing sort of happened when the Steadicam.
Yeah.
You know, that was something that was a significant piece of technology, and the cost of entry was high, and this was for the big boys in Hollywood. And then slowly over time, we have come to a place where having a Steadicam-like setup is totally reasonable for a low-budget production. I think we'll be in the same place where we don't need to rent a helicopter for 2 days to get the money shot.
Oh, you've got your little quadcopter drones.
Yeah. I agree.
That, you know, cost probably like $1,000 each to do crazy stuff that these days only the government is using to, you know, lob missiles at people on the other side of the planet. So let's talk about post. I think we've covered production. Basically, production, it's going to be a sci-fi wonderland of awesomeness, not cost you very much, and start hashing out those creative ideas now, folks.
And one more thing I would say about production, and it's going to apply to post as well. At the end of the day, though, the tools don't make the project. You got to have a mindful director and producer.
You got to have good creative
good
talent.
Good people here.
And technical operators who are really up on these new technologies, because they're not going to probably be absolutely trivial to use. And in fact, they may even require deeper levels of technical savvy than you typically run into for a smaller production company.
And that would be a smart thing to say overall. I think the days of not, as we're entering into the discussion about post-production, the days of being involved in production and not having a sense of what the post-production element entails, they're over.
Right out. Right
they're
out. Because they now that it's all just data back and forth, I think they're more tightly linked than they've ever been.
I agree. You got to have a good sense of technology in order to feel comfortable in this environment moving forward. I mean, there's just no question about it. But so let's talk about post-production.
Wow, post 2020, post-production 2020.
Well, I think we'll
the cloud.
Probably.
I just felt like saying
the cloud.
I just felt you like just saying felt, the cloud.
Well, I don't necessarily. Let's back it up for a second.
Everyone says the cloud. All of our clients are constantly like, but what about the cloud?
Well, I just felt, you ever see that movie Accepted with Justin Long where he makes his own college?
Oh, no, but I've seen the trailer.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. But there's this one really funny, there's this ancillary character that out of the middle of nowhere, he just goes, Battle Royale!
Nice.
And that's how I feel right now when you just said the cloud, because I have no idea why you said it. You just wanted to say it, huh?
I don't know. The cloud is the future of technology, right? That's what all the marketing people have told me.
Yeah, they told me that about Web 2.0 as well. And the iOmega Jazz Drive. So, like, let's back
it
up.
That was pretty awesome. It was like, Your data cartridge.
Your data cartridge holds.
iOmega, serving all of your futuristic data cartridge needs since 1994.
Yeah, yeah. But, so, I believe that in year 2020, as far as codecs are concerned, we're probably going to be in a place where we're still going to have various flavors. I don't ever think there's going to be a way
consolidation. I'm with you. I bet you there are more formats, more codecs, more wrapper formats for files, more whole, you know, these days we have a lot of different variances of things, but there's a lot of stuff that's H.264 actual encoded material one way or another. By 2020, H.265, which is an actual format, that'll be ubiquitous, and maybe even the next generation of encoding technology beyond that. But I'm guessing by the end of this decade, the logical follow-up of H.264, which again I think is H.265, is going to be pretty ubiquitous at that point. I think there will be multiple streaming formats. I think you're right. Yeah. It's going to be more diverse and more difficult in some ways.
And I feel bad for any cultural archaeologists who have to go back in another 40 years and even maintain or view.
You joke about that, but as you know, we have some dealings with the Library of Congress, and mm-hmm. we know the folks at LOC who have this project that's ongoing.
It's tough.
To not only digitize their existing format of like films and things like that, but then, you know, continually bring in new stuff that's being created, because they basically try to hold everything in their archives.
You know, there's some metric like something like over 50% of all the film that has been shot pre-1950
has been lost or
has not been digitized.
Oh yeah, there,
and the other half has been, you know, like there's, you think about it, the last 100 years of technology and how much of our culture we haven't even managed to get up to our current technology
crazy.
Set.
And these guys literally at LOC, they're having to think about, you know, 1,000 years from now, how is someone going to be able to reconstruct this data? So forget that. How are you going to be able to wrangle all of these formats? I think the workflows will have probably improved. We're certainly trying to do our part there by doing a lot of these workflow management systems.
I wonder. I'm just having an aha moment here.
Well, I see the light bulb over your
head. Yeah,
shining brightly.
I wonder if, because we now are in a truly tapeless workflow world, that in the next 8 years, we're going to see a higher level of integration into the NLE of the data management and the storage. If there's going to be marriage of those in one product.
I would think the tools will have evolved to the point where, and I think this is kind of what Apple's in some ways tried to achieve with Final Cut 10. And they may end up being more successful than some people think now. That the actual creative user, the person whose job it is to tell stories successfully through moving picture and sound, will not have to be as directly in touch with my data storage system, my media asset management system, my editing tool, my motion graphics tool. I think some of these technologies will start to get more and more obfuscated or hidden from the actual end creative user, and the user interfaces will really be more intuitively driven about, these are the tools, or here are the interfaces you need to do the next thing in your workflow that needs to be done, but it'll be much more streamlined around just, here's what you need to have in front of your face. You know, I look at NLE software today, all of it, even Final Cut 10, although Final Cut 10 is the best at this. And it shows you too much on the screen at once. Things should be much more hidden away from you if 99% of the time you don't have to see it. If I don't have to be looking at it, I think it's too confusing to have it on the screen.
I think a good analogy, I'm sort of thinking Minority Report. I'm sort of thinking how that's all sort of spread out onto a table.
Murder.
Yes. Red rum. Just, you know. Because you said The Shining. Anyway.
We're bringing it all back around.
So in many ways, post-production is a puzzle. It is taking an entire puzzle and it is pouring every single piece out onto a table. And then it is trying to assemble it. And sometimes there are more pieces in the puzzle than you need. So you got to try them, and then maybe they fit, maybe they don't, but you're taking them out, you're putting them in, and you have basically a workspace. And then all this other stuff that we have in NLE today is kind of like, it can be overkill. I mean, when you look at Avid is an NLE that was designed with its genesis in analog film editing.
There's absolutely.
There's a bin because There was a bin.
There were bins for your little snippets of film. Absolutely.
You know, and then Final Cut 7 and pre-FCPX.
Yeah, isn't the icon for the cut tool in most of these applications still a razor?
It is still a razor.
I think the question is, you know, what elements of these paradigms are legacy? And putting all of that complexity in front of the user. And let's face it, folks, cutting video is mostly selecting an endpoint, selecting an outpoint, arranging them in a sequence,
just imagine
some level of filters and effects and
transitions.
Imagine
if you just had a full touch interface for that, in which you only interacted with the video components and you simply dragged them down and selected them with your left finger and your right finger, then went whoop.
And then, let's be honest here, despite all of the criticism of the direction they've taken with their quote-unquote pro editing software, which of the three big A's in the world of video editing software seems like they are going out of their way to push us towards this? And to the degree that people often joke about being able to envision the iPad version of it, it's Apple. And
it
it's
is
Final
Apple.
Cut 10.
It's certainly Apple. And, you know,
they might not be successful.
People are comfortable with the things that they do. I personally like editing on a keyboard. But if this was 20 years ago, I might be a different guy saying, well, I like to cut analog film. So I really think it's a matter of what you learned on.
I think gestural interfaces, we've just seen the beginning. And the iPad and things like that are a sign of it. But the fact that even you have to touch something physically, I think the next generations of gestural interfaces, and this isn't even new technology, the Nintendo Entertainment System in the mid-80s had gestural interfaces that you didn't have to touch anything. You may remember these little setups where you could wave your hands around and there were these little bars that I think they used infrared and they knew what your hand's position in space was across three dimensions. And I think that Minority Report type of interface you're describing, where you're waving your hands and you're pointing at things and you're grabbing virtual objects in space. By 2020, I would not be surprised if there's a decent chance that more and more of those types of what seem like radical science fiction user interfaces are mainstream.
I think we're sort of going back to our roots in a sort of a new perspective. I was walking in Target the other day and I see this stocking stuffer, which I think is hilarious. It is an old phone handset with
I've seen a
plug for your iPhone. So you can walk around with your iPhone, which is a wireless cellular telephone, and speak into a handset like back when that was the cool thing. Of course, I haven't had it.
It's Bluetooth, right? Or something?
No, you plug it right into the headphone jack.
I've seen Bluetooth headsets that just look like old school telephones that you'd stick on your
head. I mean, perhaps we're headed
awesome.
Towards a steampunk future.
Love it.
Where, you know,
I'm ready to put on my bomber jacket and my goggles.
We're
going to
have touch
augmented reality user interface.
We're going to have like touch rotary phones where you have to slide your finger. It's amazing the things that change. You know, the other day I said to a young relative, could you roll down the window? He looked at me, roll down the window. What an antiquated phrase, right? Because when's the last time...
What are you rolling anymore?
Yeah, when's the last time you had to sit there and go like... unless,
it's
of course,
hilarious.
You know.
Or dial the phone, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, all of these things. And you designing user interfaces that mimic kind of outmoded user interfaces is called skeuomorphism. Apple's often usually attacked for doing it. Like, why does their calendar app actually have little, like, leather stitching in it? Why does their
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know if it's good or bad, but
we seem to want to remember the past in a way that we can embrace the future.
Someday we'll be dead, and whoever's, like, the people then will be like, what's leather?
Yeah.
What's a cow?
Or,
you know?
I can't believe they didn't have... They had, like, screens that weren't touch interfaces.
What did they do before everyone just lived their entire life in a pod and plugged the internet into their brain?
Well,
from
you know,
the age of 6 months.
What I was thinking about this the other day, actually. The idea of watching a series on Netflix versus purchasing the Blu-ray or the DVD, the number one deciding factor that popped into my head, and this maybe is an indication of how lazy I am, but it also is an indication of the way the market is going, that I thought I would rather watch it on Netflix because that meant that I didn't have to get up to change the disc when the first disc was done, you know.
Wow.
Of course, there's also other things like, you know, on Blu-ray.
But you're absolutely right. I was over at my friend's house watching movies the other day, and we were all sitting around and we're kind of being lazy. But my buddy was like, we were trying to decide whether we were going to do on demand through Comcast or not to watch a movie, or turn the Netflix for the Wii on. And like, it was this big ordeal that he didn't want to have to get up to literally click one button on the front of the television to change the input channel over to the Wii so we could see what was on Netflix, because it meant having to walk 8 feet across the room. So I made a big, I was like, oh, I'll do it, man. Here, give me some gear so I can go on this expedition across the room. And, oh! So, you know, of course he felt kind of embarrassed in his lard ass kind of way, but... No, I think you're right. I think people make these kind of cost evaluations now, and it's like, well, the less I have to do, you know, it's like that talk I gave to, you know, that industry group. It was like a year ago. You know, it was the American Media Manufacturers Association, no longer named that, but that's really what they were. And I was like, guys, the idea of physical media, if that's what your business model is based on, when we're now like coming to true 4G cellular technology and being able to beam something at a gigabit speed from anywhere you are. And I think that, you know, it's like, that's what's coming.
I mean,
and I think physical objects to convey ones and zeros is right out. It's out.
It is out. I mean, I remember having the argument when I was younger, who's going to get up and flip the laser disc, right? So
you and me, you realize we were the only people with Laserdisc players watching our imported Japanese animation Laserdiscs and downloading the English translated scripts online.
Dude, we agreed that we would not talk about this on air.
Is it air when it's going across the internet?
Oh, how clever of you. But yeah, so we're going to see a lot of change in post. I don't think we're going to see a significant change in post in the way that we're going to see a significant change in production in the same time
frame.
Well,
but here's a thing that I think will change. Just looking at the trajectory of internet speed increases available at reasonable prices.
Well, let me ask you this then.
No physical delivery to the networks anymore.
Physical delivery. That's an interesting question. Well, I agree as far as end product. That's already happening. There are lines.
It's already happening. You might have your Aspera link to your provider or whatever, but or just FTP it or whatever. But I'm saying that by the end of the decade, that will be the way you get your content to someone. It will only be online.
Right. The idea of delivering a master tape will probably seem kind of quaint.
No master tape, no master videotape, no master data tape, no couriered hard drive. You will give them a copy of files across your internet connection.
Well, so here's a question for you. So I'm supposing this. I don't really know the answer to this. I don't think either of us do. So with all this technology sort of pointing towards, again, tapeless data that we're already handling in some physical manner, are we, now maybe we can talk about the cloud, or the concept of a cloud, or the concept of really what we're talking about here is third-party hosted servers that are internet-connected at a very high rate of speed that you can upload and download your data quickly. So does that mean, if this becomes the norm, that we're going to see an NLE platform which has zero local storage and which you literally edit off of the cloud?
Well, Merrill, I will tell you this, that a phone call that I was on less than 2 hours ago with one of the big three A's of the video post-production world was talking about them doing this, and in fact the branding of it has actually already been established. They've already started talking about it. It's Adobe Anywhere, and you may remember to the event that we did with Avid that they're talking about Avid Sphere, which is remote based editing. Now, not all of these technologies imply that the master quality footage lives in the cloud per se. It may still live on a centralized storage system that you have under your control. However, the idea of this is that an actual editor on their computer editing doesn't necessarily have to contain the master quality editable material on their local storage.
Their metadata, their edit lists, all the things they can generate.
You're just making pointers to things. Let a computer somewhere else do the hard
work. You're generating all the associated data, but that data is not the video data. That is the overlay data. That is the ins, the outs, the transitions,
the
layers.
So I'm willing, you're absolutely right. I'm willing to say this. By the end of the decade, to do certain types of tasks in the post-production workflow that today require, for lack of a better term, oomph on the processing side, media encoding, rendering, transcoding, data storage, if that oomph is kind of the actual storage of the high-quality data itself, whereas the vast majority of that is being done on the client side or in a server in your facility on the server rack, whether it's the cloud or maybe a more centralized facility that you're tapping into that maybe is still under the control of your organization or company, maybe it's your private cloud, but I'm willing to bet the weight has shifted where the bulk of those heavy duty IT tasks are not happening in your local facility, even if you are the user of those tools. By the end of the decade, more people than not will have those tools somewhere at a distance from them, outside of their actual geographic location. There's a bet I'm willing to take.
You know, well, here's another question for you. I'm just thinking about outmoded technology we currently use, technology that maybe we like, but because we have a nostalgia associated with it. Do you think in the next 8 years we're going to see film still as the primary source for movies that are
coming
out of
Hollywood? If I'm not mistaken, the shift already occurred.
I mean, there's still a high rate of
There's a lot, but I was up at Postworks recently. I was talking to one of their principals. I was talking to their head of technology. They're owned by the same parent company as Technicolor. And they were showing me the actual, I guess it's not technically a telecine if it's not turning it into a videotape, but it was the scanning system, because they still shoot 30 Rock on film. And 30 Rock gets turned into files, and that's where they use the digital intermediaries for the post-production process. And they were saying that's one of the last few we're getting that's being shot on film. They said many, many fewer things are coming into their facility these days on film. Those machines are getting less and less use. And it's all about the digital workflow. Arri Alexa, you know, obviously Red, even the DSLRs, even video cameras. And I'm sure plenty of new ones that are coming online with large sensors, narrow depths of field, you know, all that fun stuff.
Sure.
But I think maybe the minority is actually being on film now.
As far as television, I would agree. But I think there is still a very large contingent in feature film.
I would change your question up. I would be willing to make the rhetorical question, will anybody be shooting film by the end of the decade? In 8 years, will anybody be producing cinema outside of kind of artisanal use of film because I think it's a cool medium to work in, but for like the bulk of the actual industry?
Yeah, because nobody uses, if we're looking historically,
I mean, people
here,
still
nobody
still
shoots on a Polaroid anymore, you know,
but
unless you're a hipster.
Except for the ones who do, exactly. Except for the hipsters, and they have their little Olga cameras or whatever with their 110 yeah. film or whatever. But
now we have Instagram to simulate the
exactly. It's so funny.
That's another.
But
one
I would be willing to bet that for true kind of commercial entities, nobody is using
yeah,
film
they don't,
by the
they
end
don't
of
shoot,
the decade.
And speaking of commercials, they don't really do that in commercials anymore either. So there's
nope.
like
Arri took over everything, man. People
I mean,
are so comfortable with Arri.
And Kodak, they went bankrupt last year.
Yeah.
It's
I think that for true commercial purposes, again, not just shooting of commercials, but like commercial production world, you know, cinema, Hollywood, television, what have you, I don't think people will be using film anymore. I think it'll be hipsters of the year 2020
in
art school.
I think it won't go away entirely. There'll always be those pockets.
But I mean, there's still vinyl.
Especially,
there's still, you know.
Yeah, and especially,
things like that.
You know, any Hollywood film with a big budget where, you know, a hoity-toity director may want to do it, that'll probably still happen.
I doubt it. Because Scorsese's still shooting on film, I believe. Do you think he's really going to be making a lot of movies in 8 years? Maybe, but these guys are getting old.
Yeah, but that, I don't mean the hoity-toity guys that are old. I mean the hoity-toity guys that are middle-aged.
Yeah, but that, again, I think the economics of shooting in that medium will be so weighed against you, your financiers will not let you do it.
I don't disagree, but I also know that you know, logic and cost really don't have much to do with the Hollywood budget these days, so.
Merrill, because we've spent a lot of time talking about all of the fun changes coming in production and post, I think we should table the discussion on the distribution, consumption, and beyond.
Yeah.
And do a whole show on it.
Well, yeah, I could.
We'll do part B of the
I could talk about what I think might happen in 8 years without any sort of reference or backup for another hour. I mean,
I kind of get the feel that our listeners may actually get the sense that we're extraordinarily geekified when it comes to thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, no, it's very exciting.
Which would be true. We're geeks.
Yeah, you know, but I think it's important to be forward-looking with this kind of stuff. I think it's also
Absolutely.
Important to be receptive to the possibility of change. If we are not at least open to the idea of entertaining changes in workflow and things like that. Just imagine where we would be. We would still be working on reel-to-reel. I think it's important to be aware and be hopeful and be receptive, but
well,
at the same time...
Well, if you want to have a job, man, you got it. These days, with the dynamics of our current economy, I mean, you know, everyone worries all these jobs that have been lost and this and that. It's like, I'm sorry, folks, but the realities of the just how easy it is to find people with skill sets that you need to achieve whatever you're doing for a commercial purpose, it's so easy to connect with people. You have to differentiate yourself. You always have to be several steps ahead. Even
and you have
if it's
to,
thinking 5 years out, you have to be.
To that end, you can't just be a production guy now.
No.
You can just make your money in that, but you need to be fully aware of everything that is in the circle of production life. So it can't just be, I shoot it and then I'm done. You need to be aware. You need to be aware of the delivery of the format. You need to be aware of how it's going to be cut and who's going to cut it and what's it going to be cut in and the entire scenario. In the year 2020, I think we're going to see everything that we see right now just bigger and better or maybe not better.
And I'm going to have a virtual girlfriend.
You're going to have a virtual girlfriend. You can download, you know, different versions. Be like that Futurama episode with Lucy Liu.
I think we should probably end on that note.
Okay. The year 2020, when you can download Lucy Liu. As always, if you have questions, comments, or feedback, send us an email at workflowshow@chessa.com.
Alrighty. Thanks, guys. Stay tuned for next week.